Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings. Dr. Ladson-Billings is the former Kellner Family Distinguished Professor of Urban Education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction and a faculty affiliate in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is the former president of the American Educational Research Association, and she is currently the president of the National Academy of Education. Dr. Ladson-Billings' research examines the pedagogical practices of teachers who are successful with African-American students. She also investigates critical race theory applications to education. Dr. Ladson-Billings, thank you for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So we're now about a year and a half into the COVID-19 pandemic, and about a year removed from the protests and civil unrest following the murder of George Floyd. In light of everything that's happened, what, in your view, have policymakers done well during this time to support students in schools, in particular Black students? And alternatively, on what issues or in what areas do you think policymakers have failed or could have done a better job?
Well, I think, you know, no one anticipated that the pandemic would hit in such a way. But I would think that one of the things that policymakers did well, and I would probably say policymakers and administrators, is to ensure that students got devices as a way to access. Now, that doesn't talk about the lack of internet access, but they got the devices. And I think, you know, almost everywhere I went, I either saw Chromebooks or tablets or some way, some device. I think the second thing they did well is that they recognized that their work is beyond the academic. And so many, many districts provided food. Food insecurity is one of the major issues that students face in both urban and rural communities. And I think one of the things that the public has now realized is that our schools are standing in the gap around things beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic, that for many students, those meals, sometimes twice a day, both breakfast and lunch programs, 5 days a week, are the difference in going hungry and having something to eat. So I think those were some things they did well. I think the other thing that they did well is they said, let's not worry about this testing. That's not the first emergency. So those are things that I would give them some credit for. I think I might also say that they began to notice that social emotional learning is as important as academics. So those are things that I think we really did sort of step up to the plate on. Some things that they have fallen short on, I think, is creating a rhetoric around things like, quote, learning loss. I often say, when I think about the pandemic, I don't think of everybody being in the same boat. I know that's the expression. We're all in the same boat. No, we're all in the same storm. But some people rode out the storm on a luxury liner, right? They had internet access. They, you know, you and I work from home. I mean, in some ways, we didn't miss a beat. We missed the companionship and the colleagueship. But we still were able to get our work done. There were others who really rode the storm out, holding on to a piece of driftwood, barely having their heads above water, because they were, quote, essential workers. And so they'd go out every day and put their lives at risk. They had to become caregivers, which meant they had to give up jobs, or their jobs ended. They might have been wait staff and the restaurant closed. So we're not in the same boat. We're all in this storm together. And so I think the discussion about learning loss, first of all, doesn't square with what we know about cognitive psychology. You know, you're unlikely to lose learning unless you have some kind of traumatic brain injury or dementia. You know, what students had was opportunity loss. They were learning all along. In fact, if they just looked out their windows and saw what was happening in the streets in the summer of 2020, they were learning a lot about civics and social unrest and protests, but they were not learning the conventional things that schools offer. So I think that the rhetoric has been a challenge. I think the other thing I worry about, and I still worry about this, is what I think of as a missed opportunity. If you've read some of the stuff I've written lately, I've talked about the need for a hard reset, that this in some ways gives us, you know, takes us back to a starting point where we say, you know what, let's do this differently. Let's not keep doing what we were doing. We already knew there were inequities. So let's not exacerbate it by continuing to do the same old thing. What I find interesting is I've been in conversations with people in the testing industry, and they themselves have said, we don't think we can keep doing this. We don't think this is sustainable. People at ETS and the College Board are all saying things to me like, look, the colleges and universities are already backing away from standardized tests. Maybe this is the wrong way. But at the school level, we keep thinking, oh, we got to get ready for the test. They're not going to do well on the next test, as if the test is inevitable. And I just think we fail to capture the narrative at the moment the public was on our side.
So building on that first question, there are two issues that I'd like to ask you about specifically. The first is a debate, and I know the listeners can't see me, but I'm putting debate in quotation marks because I really hesitate to categorize it as a debate, since it stems to an opposition to critical race theory. And in my opinion, they aren't really arguing against critical race theory, but you are the expert. So, and I know you've already been asked this probably a million times by now, but how would you explain critical race theory and what, in your view, are detractors actually arguing against?
Well, at its base, critical race theory is an attempt to explain racial disparity. Plain and simple. And I keep saying to people who say they don't want it, well, give me your explanation. Help me understand, from your point of view, why we have this regular and predictable pattern that falls along racial fault lines. And it can be housing, it could be employment, it could be admissions to colleges, it can be schooling outcomes. Critical race theory provides for me an explanation. I just did an interview with, I think it's Bob Rosenberg and his video series, in which I tried to explain that from before 1619 until almost the mid-20th century, our major explanation for this disparity, so it's not as if we haven't tried it before, but our major explanation was genetic. This group is just not as smart as that group, right? The idea that we had in many universities programs in eugenics, the belief that Black people, Brown people, Indigenous people were inferior. Now, we finally broke away from that a little bit by the 1950s, and I think the Brown decision is emblematic of this attempt to say, you know what, this just not so. But you also remember that there's still Jim Crow laws in place, which are all based on this notion that you're not good enough to drink water out of the same place I drink water. You're not good enough to use the same restroom I use. Somewhere around the mid-20th century, however, we begin thinking of, in terms of, well, it's just a question of opportunity. They don't have equal opportunity. Okay, I'll follow that line of reasoning. The problem is every time we try an equal opportunity strategy, you see constant rollback. Now, what's causing the rollback? So yes, we had the Brown decision, but it was followed by 5, 6, 7 decisions, Milliken, Dowell, Rodriguez, all saying, nope, we don't have to do this. Nope, we're not going to do this. Nope. So you can't just lay Brown out there as if it has been unchanged. And in fact, the most recent example is Brown gets used by white parents in Seattle in the parents involved in community schools, the PICS decision. So the equal opportunity, voting rights, where are we right now with voting rights, right? We tried affirmative action. How many affirmative action cases have we had to sort of sit through? So every time you use lack of opportunity as the reason for the disparity, you have to go back and explain, well, why do people keep rolling back the opportunities? So for me, critical race theory is the most feasible, logical, clear explanation for why this has happened. And again, you know, in that recent interview I did for Rosenberg, I pointed out that it's not about individuals. It's not about this white person who snubbed me. It's about a system. And the example that I gave was a very personal one. It was my father as a World War II veteran, although financially able, being unable to buy a home in Levittown. $8,000 for a Levittown house, $8,000 for the home in West Philly that he eventually bought. It wasn't an individual GI that kept my father out of buying a house. It was a system that allowed Clause 25 in the Levittown covenants that said no person other than a member of the Caucasian race is eligible to live, lease, or purchase a Levitt home. Now, these are thousands and thousands of homes, New York, Philadelphia, Maryland, that are all subsidized by the federal government, FHA, right? And the GI bills. So this is not individual people we're looking at. This is an entire system. Now, someone might say, oh, you know, Gloria, get over it. That was, you know, 70 years ago, right? True. But I actually went back and looked on Zillow to see how much my old houses were and how much the Levittown houses were. My old houses were $93,000. The Levitt house, $565,000. That is a system that is not allowing wealth to grow in the communities that I and other people like me were forced to live in, while individuals who are able to live in the Levitt homes are able to grow and, you know, allow their kids to go on to college. And, you know, it's interesting to me. And then more recently, I have a wonderful former student by the name of Matt Cohn. I always put his name out there because he's great, who teaches at Carrboro High School in North Carolina. And he asked his students a simple question during the pandemic. I've been visiting his class, another class in Baltimore. He asked his students to go home and find out if anybody in their family benefited from the GI Bill. Well, what happened is the white students come back and they tell all these stories about buying first homes, first person to head off to college in their families. One young man said, well, my great-grandfather bought his first home. Then he took the equity out of that home and started a mop and broom business. He became a millionaire. No Black students in his class could find an example of anybody who benefited from the GI Bill. So again, it's not about individuals being mean. So that's what I mean by that critical race theory helps me understand something systemic. Whether or not individuals commit acts of racism, I'm not a psychologist and I'm less interested in that. I'm interested in more macro sociological and cultural explanations for things. And so that's what critical race theory does for me. It gives me an explanation. As I transpose it to schools, it helps me understand why the curriculum's organized the way it is, why discipline policies fall out the way they do, why special education looks like it looks, why gifted and talented. It's a powerful explanatory model. I am happy to pick up something else if you show me something else. But thus far, no one's shown me anything else.
So what do you think the detractors think critical race theory is?
Something that makes white people feel bad. And if you look at some of the laws, you can't teach anything in some of these states if students are made to feel bad about their race. Now, my clap back on that one is, where were you people in the 1950s and 60s when I was sitting in the classroom? where were you when I had to read Huckleberry Finn? Because it made me feel bad. Where were you when I had to read Gone with the Wind? Where were you when I had to read Conrad's Heart of Darkness? So this notion that all of a sudden we have to care about one group's feelings, it's okay for Black children to experience racism. It's not okay for white children to know about it. I mean, that's really what they seem to be saying.
Are you at all concerned by the attacks on critical race theory or on its the use of critical race theory in higher education?
I'm not concerned as an individual. I feel in some ways, you know, I've had a career. You can't keep me from writing. I'm concerned about the teacher in Iowa or the teacher in Tennessee or the teacher in Florida. You know, we saw this happen in Tucson with Curtis Acosta and his colleague around Precious Knowledge. I mean, that's where my concern is. The fact that we are taking a sort of anti-intellectual approach to things is supremely American. You know, when I talk to colleagues in other parts of the world, they don't understand how we make decisions because they're like, you know, well, why wouldn't you take the person with the most education? No, we don't like that. We want the person who looks like they could have a beer with us, even when they couldn't, or if they did, they would stick us with the bill, you know?
So the second issue I wanted to ask you about is about reopening schools. So you wrote a piece entitled Stop Using Black Children as an Excuse to Open Your Schools. So now that schools are set to reopen and that we have the emerging threat of COVID variants, are you at all concerned by how schools are reopening and who might bear the brunt of the economic, emotional, and health costs if there is a surge in COVID cases?
Yeah, as I recall, the piece I wrote was a blog, and I was really talking about the fact that people didn't care about the equity issue before COVID closed the schools. The schools were inequitable at that time. So now all of a sudden, you're very, very worried about equity. I find it disingenuous. Now, what I also find very interesting as I've talked to a number of Black parents is I'm surprised at how many of them have trepidations, not about sending their kids back to school around COVID, but around how their kids will be treated. You know, I've talked to so many parents who said, you know, I know it seems weird, but this was one of the best years for my kid because his teachers had to interact with me around the academics. They were not calling me about his behavior. That they had to, you know, sort of reach into our households through the Zoom or whatever platform and explain things. I mean, and that my kid was less anxious. You know, this is the first year that I haven't had to go up to the school for every, you know, perceived misbehavior on his part. So there are people who want to hold their kids back for their own sort of well-being, which I think I find really interesting. I mentioned that I've been visiting high schools in a couple places, and I remember visiting a high school in Baltimore. And of course, the very first thing I wanted to ask the kids is, you know, how are you guys coping with this remote learning? I'm waiting to hear the list of complaints. And this one young man says to me, "Ooh, I love it. I absolutely love it." I said, "Really?" I said, "You know, what do you love about it?" He said, "Look, when these people get on my nerves, I just turn them off." Mm-hmm. I said, so what happens when you do that? He says, "Oh, well, you know, they'll eventually call me on the phone, but then I tell them mm-hmm. I'm having internet connectivity problems." Now, I laughed just like you did, but when I really thought about it, what this youngster was saying to me was, for the first time in my life, I am in control of my learning. Because if I turn them off, again, I'm doing air quotes here, by putting my head down, putting my hoodie up, there's sanctions. I'm getting put out. I might get suspended. But the availability of the technology is like, when I've had enough, I've had enough.
So I want to continue our conversation about educational policy, but I want to shift the conversation a little bit towards the future. So you mentioned this already earlier, but you wrote an article entitled, "I'm Here for the Hard Reset, Post-Pandemic Pedagogy to Preserve Our Culture." And I'd like to read the quote that you cite at the beginning of the article. So you quoted Arundhati Roy, who said, "Historically, pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine their world anew. This one is no different. It is a portal, a gateway between one world and the next." So first, let me ask you, what motivated you to write this piece?
Well, I guess I've always been one of these folks who you know, looked at, when people say the sky is falling, I often say, is it? Or if they say everything is just fine, I say, is it? You know, I've always asked the other question from the earliest part of my career, the question that I asked that ended up producing the study and then the book, The Dream Keepers, was rather than ask the question, what was wrong with Black kids? I asked, well, what's right with them? So I think just my fascination with the quote, other question. I used Arundhati Roy because I just think her writing is so compelling. I could have just as easily used a statement from Rahm Emanuel, which I think he ripped off from Winston Churchill, which is never let a good crisis go to waste, right? We had a good crisis. We had a major crisis. The other thing that sort of prompted me to write the piece is that I think we were so fixated on the COVID-19 or the coronavirus pandemic, and we weren't paying attention to what I saw as three other pandemics. The second one is the pandemic of anti-Black racism, which sort of came to a head with the murder of George Floyd. And I call it pandemic because I got calls and emails and texts from colleagues around the globe, you know, colleagues in the UK saying, look, we got the same stuff. Colleagues from France saying, hey, we deal with this all the time. Colleagues in Canada, look, we just dug up this thing and found all these indigenous kids. This happens everywhere. And in fact, I'm giving a talk to a school in Nova Scotia tomorrow about the experience of Black students on that campus. Colleagues in Australia. I mean, so it's a worldwide phenomenon. So that was the second pandemic. The third one is my concern about an economic collapse. I mean, the government's doing a lot of stuff to prop up the economy. But the truth of the matter is that a lot of people were out of work, a lot of people on the edge of eviction, foreclosure. And we know, and again, I would call it pandemic because of the interconnectedness of global markets. So if things go south here, it doesn't help people in Europe, you know, that we buy our stuff from all around the world. If we can't buy it, it reverberates. And then the fourth one, environmental catastrophe. I mean, I'm particularly tuned into California because my grandchildren all live on the West Coast. And I lived on the West Coast for a long time. So these fires, more of them, more intense, longer fire seasons. But there's also more intense storm seasons in the Gulf Coast. You know, here we, this storm that just came through, Henri, I mean, they said they hadn't anticipated a storm like this in the Northeast in many, many years. We hadn't had one. So all four of these things are happening at the same moment, and our students are in the midst of all of it. So what I wanted people to pay attention to, as bad as COVID is, it's one of several pandemics that we have to cope with and that we have to do something about.
So you said that you're here for the hard reset. So what are a few policies that you think policymakers and other educational stakeholders should lean into? And alternatively, what are some that you think they should rethink?
Well, I think the whole testing regime is one of those things that they should just, they really need to rethink that. There are institutions of higher ed, and higher ed often leads the way. I mean, the curriculum we have in high schools is because of what colleges require, right? You know, no, 4 years of English is not arbitrary. It's because that's what the college folks want. So the fact that Stanford, the University of Texas has actually been doing this for a while. This year, the University of Wisconsin, test optional. You don't need to give us a test in order to be admitted. So I think that that's something that we need to think about. The world didn't come to a screeching halt because we didn't test last year. I'm not saying that you have to, quote, scrap tests, but maybe putting them in a broader perspective might mean we don't need to test every year. You know, maybe we should do it every other year. Maybe we should do it every three. I mean, what's the big deal about the testing every single year? So I think that's something we could really rethink. The other thing, and I know this is probably heresy among some folks, but I have been saying over and over, let's get rid of the whole concept of remediation. If I'm already behind, explain to me how slowing me down catches me up. I mean, just the semantic logic of that doesn't make sense. So I've been really pushing schools and districts to think about the concept of acceleration, the concept of dual enrollment. I'm actually talking with my superintendent here in Madison to either consider, as a condition of high school graduation, that every student have at least one AP class. And not all AP classes are, quote, academic. There are AP classes in leadership, right? If that's not feasible because you don't have enough teachers who are certified, what about making sure that everybody takes at least one honors class? Again, honors doesn't just have to be biology or honors history. It could be an honors art class or a music class. If you can't do AP for everybody, if you can't do honors for everybody, at least one, how about everybody take at least one college level course? Again, it doesn't have to be English. It doesn't have to be chemistry or calculus. We actually teach dance on the campus of the University of Wisconsin. Why couldn't a high school student take a college dance course? What is my point here is I want these students to understand that these campuses should not be alien to them. Their parents are paying taxes, particularly with the land grants. Their parents are paying taxes like everybody else. They're supporting these institutions. They ought to have an experience on them. If they get there, take the course and say, you know what? I don't know if I want to go to college. That's fine. But I'm willing to bet a lot of them will say, well, I didn't have any idea you could have this kind of fun on a college campus. You know, I mean, I just think we want to accelerate learning. We don't want to stymie kids. And we want to, you know, one of the things I've been telling faculties and principals is I'm not saying to do all of this stuff by fiat. I think we don't do enough experimentation in schools. We just walk in one day and say, okay, tomorrow, everybody, you have to do six trait essays. I don't care how you've been teaching writing before, this is how you have to. It's that kind of stuff that just makes teachers crazy and just decide, you know what, I'm not doing it, and sabotage any kind of innovation. I've been quoting John Dewey, who says something like, if we teach today's children like we taught yesterday's, we will rob them of tomorrow. And quite frankly, we are still teaching a 19th century curriculum, not even a 20th century curriculum. And so here we are, the most scientifically advanced nation. Our kids are just submerged in technologies. And we act like everybody's still using a slate, you know, to write down ciphers or whatever people used to do. What I'm suggesting is that the curriculum really needs to come into the 21st century, and that these sort of isolated subject areas are not making sense in the same way. One of the reasons why I think most of us like graduate school is because we get to study one thing. We don't have to be worried about all of that superfluous. I'm not saying they shouldn't know more things. What I'm saying is we've got to be much more creative and imaginative in the way we go about it.
Thank you, Dr. Latson-Billings. Next month, we'll speak with Audrey Waters, who's a journalist who covers education technology and who's the author of the book Teaching Machines, The History of Personalized Learning. As always, thanks for listening. We hope you're safe and healthy. And remember, for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweet.